Welcome back to another episode of the Real Talk on Women's Health podcast with Essentia Health. I have a guest who's actually been on the podcast a few times, so it's a familiar face. We have cardiologist Dr. Catherine Benziger. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I highly recommend everybody, if they haven't checked out your previous episodes, to circle back and listen to those. But today we're talking about obesity and diabetes and how it relates to heart disease. So let's just kick things off by talking about the relationship between obesity and the risk of developing diabetes and heart disease in women.
Yeah, obesity is something that we all are pretty familiar with. The prevalence of diabetes and obesity is on the rise. Obesity has doubled since 1980 in this country, and worldwide there are over 600 million people who are overweight or obese, which is about 40 to 50% of the U.S. population. And we use this metric called the body mass index, or BMI, to sort of define obesity. And, you know, usually if your BMI is between 25 to 29, you're considered overweight. And if your BMI is over 30, you're considered obese. And as your BMI goes up, your relationship with having other risk factors such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, glucose intolerance, or developing diabetes also goes up. So it's really important to know, you know, what your normal weight is and what your BMI is, and making sure you're trying to stay more in the normal range.
So you mentioned that the obesity rate has been increasing. Why is that?
There's a lot of reasons why obesity has been on the rise over the past 30 or 40 years. I think a lot of it has to do with our lifestyles and the foods that we're eating. So it's really easy to get very high caloric foods, and people aren't as active as they used to be. They don't walk as much in their daily routines. They're not exercising as much, and they're eating really calorie-dense foods and taking in more calories than they're expending. I think this has also been exacerbated by, you know, people working from home potentially too, where you're not even getting the normal steps that you would when you have to park in a parking lot and walk into work or walk to the bathroom. Sometimes if I work from home, I maybe am getting 2,000 steps in a day, where we recommend people get 8 to 10,000 steps a day. And it can be really hard to do that without actually intentionally going for a walk or getting some sort of exercise.
Yeah, I think we're all guilty of that, because I do the same thing where if I'm in the office, I only get, like, you know, a few thousand steps. So how does obesity impact women's heart health differently than men?
I think obesity affects women more than it does men, particularly in certain racial subgroups. For example, African-American women tend to have the highest rates of obesity, and so they're just at higher risk for then developing all of the complications related to obesity. So we know that obesity leads to high blood pressure, can lead to, again, high cholesterol, glucose intolerance, which is your body's inability to be able to handle the sugars that you're eating, and then you can develop diabetes. But it also can cause inflammation, something called metabolic syndrome, and other things that lead to stress on the body. And over time, these can lead to long-term effects on the heart and the kidneys, things like thickening of the heart muscle and something called HFpEF, or heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, when the heart gets really stiff. It can also lead to problems with sleep and something called obstructive sleep apnea, which can put stress on the heart and cause problems like pulmonary hypertension and the right side of the heart to be affected as well. So there's a lot of downstream effects that come from having obesity over, you know, decades.
So does the prevalence differ between men and women? I feel like a common thread on this podcast is when a doctor comes in and we're talking about something, it actually happens more in women. So is that the case with this?
Yeah. And I think BMI is not a great way that we define obesity. I think waist circumference, particularly, you know, where you hold your fat, affects probably your heart disease risk more than anything. And we don't routinely measure waist circumference, but I think women tend to hold their fat more in their waist and in their middle section. And that tends to lead to more heart disease than people who have weight distributed all over their body.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how does diabetes impact your risk for heart disease? I guess I never would think that there was a connection between the two.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that heart disease is a problem with the heart arteries that bring blood to the heart, and they get plugged up, and they can get plugged up with what we call plaque. And plaque is a mixture of things, including cholesterol and other things that circulate in the body. It can stick to the walls of the arteries, and diabetes tends to cause a lot of inflammation and other things that promote this plaque buildup. And so when you have both high cholesterol and diabetes, and for example, if you're a smoker as well, you tend to have much more plaque or cholesterol and all of this hardening of the arteries than someone who doesn't have diabetes or high cholesterol. And the buildup of the plaque is what causes heart attacks and can have people develop symptoms related to these blocked arteries, usually in the form of chest pain or shortness of breath. Usually it's with exertion. Usually it's better when you rest. So most people experience these symptoms when they're going up a flight of stairs or up an incline or doing something more exertional than they're used to. And that can be a sign of heart disease.
So we've been talking about obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. So I kind of want to jump and talk about those three things in general when it comes to lifestyle modifications that we can do to prevent or manage all three, obesity, diabetes, and heart disease in women.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been really good randomized control trials about lifestyle changes, particularly exercise. There have been a number of studies looking at exercising 3, 4, 5 times a week for even as short as 12 weeks up to maybe 52 weeks or a year. And you can even have major impacts with just doing something, trying to increase that physical activity, even a 3-month walking program. We, you know, recommend usually 150 minutes per week, 30 to 60 minutes every day. And even if you aren't seeing a change in the number on the scale, you know, even if you don't have weight reduction, often the adipose or the fat tissue that you have can change when you start exercising more. And so even without weight loss, doing more exercise can really help reduce your risk of having heart attacks. And so exercise, I think, is the biggest lifestyle change that most people need to make when they get diagnosed with obesity or diabetes to try to start making those healthy choices. The second thing is dietary changes. And I think there's been a lot of literature over the past, you know, 30, 40 years looking at different diets. There's a lot of fad diets that come and go. They maybe have been shown to have reductions in weight over the short term, maybe 2 or 3 months, but a lot of them are not sustainable over many years. One thing that has been shown to really help improve weight loss and reduce these other risk factors is bariatric surgery. And I think that's a more extreme measure that some people do need to take to really get the weight loss off, because diet alone often is ineffective at sustaining weight loss. I think it's still important that we're being conscientious about what we're eating and trying to be heart healthy in what we eat and watching the salt or sodium intake, watching the saturated fats, trying to limit sugar sweetened beverages and sort of candy and sweets and things that are going to make our diabetes worse. But overall, diet alone is probably insufficient for maintaining weight loss. Fortunately, now we also have medicines. So there are a number of medicines that have been shown to help in addition to bariatric surgery or instead of bariatric surgery to help people lower their risk of having heart disease and help with weight loss. And we usually define, you know, these medicines as being successful if you can lose 10% of your weight, and then you'll be less likely to have, you know, heart failure, have heart attacks, have atrial fibrillation. All of this stuff that is related to obesity has actually been shown to be reduced if we can get that 10% weight loss. And so some of these medications people might have heard of are these glucagon-like peptide receptor agonists or GLP-1 agonists like liraglutide, semaglutide, dulaglutide, or tirzepatide. And a lot of patients that I see are now on these medications.
And I do want to mention, I do have an episode of the Real Talk on Women's Health podcast about bariatric surgery. So if people are interested in going a little bit more in depth on that, they can definitely check out that episode. But I think another really common thing for women is it's just hard to lose weight, or it's hard to manage weight, especially as you get older. So what are some unique challenges that women face in managing their weight and also, you know, diabetes and heart health?
I think every decade our metabolism changes. And I think that it can be more difficult, especially once you've gone through the kind of perimenopausal period, to lose weight just due to hormonal changes and your metabolism. And this is where I think it's even more important to do regular exercise. And most people, that's just walking, as well as strength training and having more, you know, lean mass and more muscle rather than adipose tissue. And even if your BMI number is still in that overweight or obese range, having more muscle mass will help you in the long run. So I think it depends on your age, and what you can do varies as you get older. And if you have orthopedic issues or other limitations, no matter what, doing something, whether it's getting into the pool, being on a bike, going for a walk, is really important to maintain that heart healthy lifestyle.
And I feel like people always think, when they think exercise, it has to be like going to the gym and lifting 200-pound weights. But you just mentioned a lot of very easy things like swimming, walking. It doesn't have to be so intense.
That's right. We say moderate intensity exercise, like I said, for most people is just walking. Just go for a walk. It really helps if you have a pet, a dog that needs to be walked a few times a day. People who have pets tend to be healthier than those who don't, because they have to go for those walks to get the, you know, your animal exercise, just like you need exercise. More vigorous activity, you know, we only recommend, you know, up to 75 minutes a week is what you need for that heart benefit. And that's more the running, basketball, you know, soccer, you know, the sports that maybe not as many people are participating in.
So I want to talk a little bit more in depth about heart disease. Are there any gender specific symptoms or warning signs that women should be aware of?
Yes, women should be aware of the signs of heart attack. Most people will experience some sort of chest discomfort, chest tightness, chest pressure. But often I hear in men, it feels like an elephant sitting on my chest. And I have never heard a woman describe it like that. Usually they'll say it's just an annoyance or like I said, a pressure. They wouldn't even call it a pain necessarily. Often it can radiate to the shoulder or down the arm, sometimes both arms, sometimes the back. Other times it can feel like reflux. It can feel like just like upset stomach, like you would get after eating a spicy meal or, you know, something that doesn't sit well, but you weren't eating anything spicy. You know, it just sort of has this sort of burning sensation in your chest. Those are pretty common symptoms. The other thing that women often describe is just overwhelming fatigue. Like they're just got very tired. They had to take a nap. You know, things that used to be easy, maybe gardening or doing laundry, some chores around the house, just get them very winded, very short of breath, very tired, much more so than it was 3 or 6 months ago. And that can be a sign of heart disease.
So we talked about working out and exercise, but are there any dietary approaches that have shown effectiveness when it comes to managing diabetes and promoting heart health? Obviously, we want to avoid foods that are high in sodium and everything like that, but what are some other ones?
Yeah, there's a great diabetes prevention program that they run at the YMCA that has been shown for people who have prediabetes to prevent people from developing diabetes. There's also the Mediterranean diet, which has been shown to reduce risk of heart attacks, which is largely olive oil based and more seafood and really cuts back on a lot of the other animal products that we typically see here in the Midwest. But really, a lot of the fad diets have not been shown to be have sustained weight loss or have reduced heart attack rates. Things like, you know, used to be the South Beach diet, Atkins diet, you know, keto diet. Those things may give you a little bit of weight loss in the short term, but have not been shown to reduce heart attacks in the long term.
So how can individuals with diabetes advocate for themselves?
I think if you've been told you have either prediabetes or diabetes, it's very important that you have a good relationship with a primary care provider and that you see them regularly and get regular monitoring of your blood sugars, as well as your something called a hemoglobin A1C. Usually we recommend it get checked every 3 months, as well as every year, make sure you're checking your kidney function, making sure that you have your microalbumin checked to see if your kidneys are leaking protein, as well as getting your eyes checked, because diabetes is the leading cause of blindness worldwide and is the leading cause of people ending up on dialysis. So if you have prediabetes or diabetes, you want to make sure that you're getting that under control and that all of your other risk factors like your blood pressure and your cholesterol are also in check.
So we talked earlier in this podcast about how there are a bunch of different options for, you know, obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. What are the latest advancements in medical treatments? And I know we touched on those a little, but what are those?
Yeah, there's a couple of new classes of medications that have come out in the last 5 to 10 years that's shown to be beneficial, not just for helping with blood sugar, like insulin does, it helps bring down the blood sugar, but actually reduces heart attack rates and heart failure. And those are medications like these GLP-1 medications and another class of medications called the SGLT2 inhibitors. And these have really transformed how we manage diabetes. They're really the first line agents for a lot of people, often with or instead of metformin, which is very common. And more patients are getting started on these, and they have the side effect of actually helping people lose weight. So they're helping making them feel a little bit more full a little sooner, and so that they're not eating as much. And so people lose weight with the GLP-1 medications. These are often injection medications, either that you take on a daily or weekly basis. There is a pill form as well. And then the other ones, the SGLT2 inhibitors, that's a daily pill that you take, and it works in your kidneys and helps you get rid of that extra sugar. Works like a mild diuretic. There are some side effects of each of these classes of medications. The injection medications, often people can get upset stomach and feel nauseated. Often that has to do with overeating. And so people need to eat smaller, more frequent meals and just really watch the saturated fats and what they're eating. For the SGLT2 inhibitors, people can end up with increased urinary infections and fungal infections, just given the extra sugar when they are going to the bathroom. And that can be a problem for some older women in particular.
So aside from therapies and medications that you were just talking about, what about like devices or innovative technologies? Are there any of those that can help people with diabetes and monitoring heart health and all that?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish type 1 diabetes from type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes usually starts in childhood, and there's a lot of new ways that people can monitor their sugars and be able to give themselves insulin that are really innovative and very intelligent. And that's really exciting. There's a lot of people in the endocrine clinic or diabetes clinics that can help type 1 diabetics. But mostly for type 2 diabetes, which tends to occur later in life, usually due to lifestyle changes and things, the technologies and medicines that we have, while there are some new options, it really comes down to often lifestyle and some of the basic things that we just talked about exercise, making sure that you're watching the sugar and the carbs in your diet. And then if needed, there are these new medications that are now the first line medications for helping if your hemoglobin A1C doesn't come down with diet and lifestyle alone.
Is there any ongoing research or studies being done right now to better understand the relationship between diabetes and heart disease in women?
Yeah, I think women are generally underrepresented in research, especially in cardiology. I think there's a lot of reasons why there are fewer women enrolled in clinical trials. A lot of times because they were of childbearing age or childbearing potential, they were just systematically excluded from being in, you know, research on new medications and things like that. And so there are definitely now studies that are trying to intentionally enroll 50% women. There are a lot more female investigators designing studies, and they're looking at those criteria. And I would encourage, you know, any person who's being approached about being in a clinical trial to consider it. Often people who are in research, even if you're in the placebo arm, get better care than people who are just getting regular care. So research is really important in diabetes and in heart disease, and we need more women in research studies. At Essentia right now, we have a couple different ongoing research studies. One in particular that relates to diabetes is the Precedented study. This is a national study for people with type 2 diabetes. You either need to be between the ages of 40 and 80 and have heart disease with diabetes, or be between the ages of 60 and 80 and have a risk factor like obesity or smoking or kidney disease or something like that. And we are randomizing people with diabetes then to these new medications, either the SGLT2 inhibitors or the GLP-1 medications. And it's a really exciting study because we're comparing head to head, you know, which treatment option seems to be the better option for folks. And we, you know, would love to have more women in our research studies, because again, it tends to be predominantly men.
Yeah. Let's get some more women in the studies. How can research help your patients? How can studies like this help your patients?
Well, I think a lot of patients don't realize that these options are out there, and some physicians aren't as familiar with these new medications, or they think patients aren't going to be able to afford them. And by being in a research study, often you're able to get the medications either for free or you get compensated for being in the study, and so that you can better afford these medications. So there's a lot of benefits to being in the studies. You also get access to research nurses or research coordinators who are specially trained, and someone like myself, the principal investigator, who, you know, can call you if you're having any side effects or any issues. And you get a little bit more, I think, personalized one-on-one attention than you would in your usual clinic when you have very busy, you know, doctors and providers managing a lot of different patients.
Yeah, absolutely. So if someone is interested in enrolling in this study and becoming a part of it, where can they go to get more information?
If someone is interested in joining any of our research studies, you can go to the essentiahealth.org website, and there is a research page that lists all of the different research studies. The Precedented study is Precedented, Precedented, and you can read about it online and you can just Google it. You can always call our research, Essentia Institute of Rural Health, and they'll connect you with our coordinator. Right now, a lot of our research studies, we are screening patients as they come into clinic or through their electronic health record and sending messages via MyChart, which is the patient portal. And so make sure that you are active on your MyChart. It's a great way for patients and their providers to communicate, as well as for you to learn about research studies that you might be eligible for. If you're not eligible for, say, the Precedented diabetes study, there's also anyone can participate in the All of Us research program, anyone over the age of 18. And that's a great way to know if you're at increased risk of developing heart disease or diabetes or any sort of cancers. It's a National Institutes of Health program that is a great program for anyone to join.
Yeah. So if you want to be part of any of those, you know, it's better to try and then maybe you'll find one if one particular one isn't a fit for you that you can become a part of, like you just mentioned. So now that we are wrapping up this episode of the Real Talk on Women's Health podcast, I think you could probably sum it up best when it comes to obesity and heart health in women and diabetes.
Yeah, I think it's really important to get routine exercise. I always say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I mean, it's so much more important to prevent these things, stay healthy, make sure you're eating well, make sure you're going to the doctor, make sure you know your numbers, your blood pressure, your cholesterol, if you have diabetes or not, and prevent these things in the first place so that you never have to come see a cardiologist. But if you have these things, we're always happy to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cardiologist Dr. Catherine Bensinger, always love having you as a guest. I always learn so much. So thank you for being a guest.
Thanks so much.